tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Welcome to the Dolcezza Sherbert Experience. We are live from the Line Hotel. This is your host, Violeta Edelman. I'm here with my co-host,
Rob Duncan, also Dolcezza Gelato.
We are gelato makers in Washington, D.C. We have 9 locations and a factory in Northeast D.C. And today we're talking to Chef Frank Ruta. He's not only a James Beard Award-winning chef, but he's also a former White House chef that has served not one, but 3 presidents, Carter, Reagan, and George H.W. Bush. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Welcome, Frank.
Thank you.
So, Frank, when I think about you, I think about someone obsessed with making everything from scratch. And I think about someone who mostly stays in the kitchen and away from the spotlight and really focuses on food. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. I always said that I set back the chef world about 30 years because I didn't like to come out into the front and take the limelight and be the shining star. I was always one to stay down in the kitchen, toiling away, and that's where I felt most comfortable, I think.
So for what I gather, this obsession with making everything yourselves come from your Italian family.
Right.
Can you tell me about them?
We did everything.
They sound awesome, by the way.
Yeah, we did everything at home. We did, you know, we had a garden out back. We made wine. We made, things in the basement, charcuterie and so forth, prosciutto, sausage, you know, salamis. It became a trendy thing, I think. Somewhere probably in the 80s or 90s where people started doing that in restaurants. But, you know, my parents did it because it was a tradition passed on to them. You know, it was something that they did out of necessity in these small towns in Italy because they killed a pig one time a year, and it was in the fall. And they had to preserve these things throughout the year, and they had to have things available throughout the year. You know, they farmed their own land. They have everything that they ate or everything that they, you know, war, they made themselves, and it was just kind of a ritual. So it was passed on to us. It's kind of hard to give those things up. You know, we still make wine at home. We still try and do as much as we can at home to keep the traditions going. I mean, certainly we don't have to do that anymore. You know, we can buy a lot of great products, right? You know, we can buy a lot of good things around. But we just kind of like to keep the traditions going, maybe pass it on to our sons and daughters. And
so it was like being in Italy, but in Pittsburgh?
Yeah, right. It was like, well, Pittsburgh, you know, Pittsburgh was a very ethnic area. I mean,
okay.
It was, and you know, if you talk to, there were Polish families, there were Hungarian families, and each family had their own traditions, you know, and we could appreciate them. We loved the pierogies. We loved some of the other types of sausages that were made by the Hungarians. But, you know, I think that, you know, we were kind of arrogant. The Italians, I think, to a certain extent, we always thought ours was the best.
There's definitely a deep root of arrogance. That's something about that shows up down in Argentina.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of Italians down there.
Yeah. I had cousins that actually moved. They were distant cousins. I didn't know them, but my dad told me that we had cousins that had moved to South America, Argentina, Venezuela.
Yeah. So what dishes do you remember from your childhood that your grandma made?
It's kind of funny. I remember some things that I hated as a child, but love now. I think that the Sunday supper was always like the big deal. That's, you know, every day we had dinner together, but my dad worked 3 shifts in the steel mill, so we couldn't have meals together all the time because sometimes he'd be at work during dinner time. But on Sundays, we all tried to be together, and it would be always extended family, friends, neighbors, cousins. It would always be a very big, you know, I think we had 2 dining room tables in our dining room so we could fit 8, 10, or 12 people. And I think those things stand out, you know, so it was always pasta. It was always some sort of antipasta first. And, you know, the cousins would bring the wine. Then they'd argue about who made the best wine. And, you know, what did you do to it to make it so good? And it was just seemed like we had the same arguments over and over and over. But I don't know. I think the things that stand out to me are, some of the homemade things, the bread, pastas, you know, certainly those things the most.
Those are good things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing like this. Of all food, you know, fresh baked bread out of the oven with butter. I think no matter what, that's as good as it gets.
I feel bad for the gluten-free people.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's coming a long ways, but yeah.
This time of year, you know, we have peppers. So the peppers are coming on now in the garden. So I remember these people coming from, they were friends of my dad, or they were friends of my, they were my dad's age, and they were friends of the family somehow. They weren't Italian, all of them, not necessarily, but my grandmother used to make these eggs. Well, she would take this cast iron pan and fry these Italian banana peppers, the red peppers, and she would fry them until they were kind of blackened and blistered into olive oil, take them out, then she'd fry the eggs inside there so that the egg whites would kind of burst and get really crispy, and the yolk was really runny, and people would come just to have that if they were picking peppers. And every time I see a pepper, I think, I'm going to make those, and I'm kind of disappointed that people don't love them as much as I did when I was growing up. I mean, you know, my wife will eat them, my son might eat them, but I don't think they appreciate some of the history behind it that much, so...
So obviously, you know, it was in your blood to be in the kitchen. So how did you end up in the White House? What is the trajectory?
That's a funny story. I never applied at the White House. I started cooking in my hometown of McKeesport, just outside of Pittsburgh. I was in the best restaurant that was in that town. It was called the Lemon Tree, and I had graduated from an apprenticeship program that was a program that was started in Pittsburgh through the American Culinary Federation, but then it expanded to about 60 different cities. I guess they had called the people that ran that program and asked for a list of names because they were hiring, you know, they wanted to hire somebody at the White House. Mine was one of the names. I was just lucky enough to get the name. So I was working at a country club. There's no cell phones back then. This was back in 79. So they called. And I picked up the phone, and it was Mike Sansbury. I remember the name. He said, look, Frank, this is the White House calling. We'd like to ask you if you'd like to apply for a job. I said, yeah, and I hung up.
Frank.
So I hung up. And I thought it was one of my friends playing it, because I had never applied, and it's like the first, outside of Pittsburgh. I never furthest thing from my mind about going to the White House. So I think maybe a couple days later, same thing. Frank, is Mike Sansbury on the phone. Can you take the phone? I said, yes. So I go pick up the phone. I said, hello. And he said, Frank, it's Mike Sansbury again at the White House. I said, look, I'm kind of busy. And I hung up again. So they called one of my instructors, and they said, Frank, look, there's a guy trying to get a hold of you from the White House. The next time he calls, you might want to take the call. So he called back again. I took the call that time. I guess I was lucky. He didn't give up. And we set up some interviews and so forth, and I was hired later on that year, but it was, you know, just...
That was Carter?
That was right. I was hired by Mrs. Carter and then executive chef Henry Holler. And so, that was...
And that's when you came to D.C.?
Right. I was hired in like September, October of 79. I came down to do a little bit in December of 79, but I moved full-time in January 2nd, 1980. Right, so...
D.C. was a different place than now,
completely
right?
Different back then. Yeah, it was... Yeah.
That's what I hear.
Yeah.
So you get to the White House and you start cooking for the Carters. And what do you remember about them, first impressions? You walk into the White House those first weeks. What comes to mind?
First thing is, you know, the president and first lady come into the kitchen just like their home, you know. But it is their home. So it's not that unusual when you think about it. And, you know, Amy was running around. She was, I think, in sixth grade at the time. I guess you're taken aback because they're there, but they were just so down to earth. They're the nicest people. President Carter's mom, Miss Lillian, would be sitting in. It's just the kitchen's just like you would have in your house, with a kitchen table, you know, countertops, you know, cabinets. A little bit nicer probably than what most people have, but it was still just a regular, you know, home residence style kitchen. With a kitchen table in there, and oftentimes Amy would eat there, but Miss Lillian would be in there having her cup of coffee out of a styrofoam cup. She wouldn't even like to stop nice china. And it was just a family atmosphere up there where we interacted with the president and first lady. So I think that was the first thing that stuck out in my mind, is that right away you know that you're...
It's not stuffy. It's like...
Yeah, you smack dab, right? You smoked that smack dab into their personal life. It wasn't political, you know. Right. It wasn't political at all.
It's so different, I imagine, from the whole image of what the image and the idea,
right, of the president of the United States, is. What most people see on the outside, whenever that's behind all of that, it's just a regular
just
family.
Like you, me, yeah. Everybody kind of.
And for them, it was probably easier to connect because there was Amy, because there was, you know, and Chip would be in the house every now and then, and because it was more of a family setting. With the Reagans, it was a little different. They were a little bit older. But right. And they didn't have any kids. They would come visit, but there was no kids living in the house. So
talking about Amy Carter is Jimmy's daughter, and I read that she had a Siamese cat named Misty Malarkey Yin Yang.
Right.
I'm not making this up, people.
No,
is
that's
true.
Misty Malarkey, and go ahead.
She was given an elephant also from Sri Lanka that, thanks God, ended up in the zoo.
Yeah.
She roller skated through the White House and had a tree house on the South Lawn.
Right. All of that's so true.
Have you ever been?
I
want
to be Amy's friend. I mean,
did you ever go into that tree house, Frank?
I never went to tree house, no. But she did have a cat. And I'll tell you the story about the cat. You know, we had an elevator that goes up and down to the residence. It was a service elevator that connected all of the back of the house. And I'd be waiting to get on the elevator, and there would just be the cat in there. And I'd say... Well, how, and that would happen not once, not twice. And sometimes, like, you hear, whenever you're upstairs cooking, you heard the elevator opening, so you'd wonder who's getting off, and you'd go,
oh, it's Misty Malarkey
and Yang. Second floor.
Just the cat coming out, right? And so we're like,
Frank, I need my kit booster.
It was a magical cat. It had a magical name, and it was a magical cat. It could do, it could run the elevator itself. So it's kind of funny.
So you have said that at the White House you learned to be happy working behind the scenes, that the chef were domestics. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that all of us, you know, there was, when I worked there, there was a staff of 90 residents, employees, you know, butlers, maids, electricians, carpenters, housemen, different people. One guy that just washed the windows and the mirrors and the crystal chandeliers. And all of us, that's our, you know, we were domestics, more or less, right? We had to make sure that the president's day-to-day needs were cared for, one way or the other. You know, their laundry, their meals, their beds were changed, the vacuum was run, all that stuff. So, you know, we were domestics. And for us, it was, we weren't the shining light of the food service part of the, like, and not, now you think it wasn't like being in a restaurant, right? It was just completely different. So it's by nature, I think I'm also like to keep in the back, but I think because we were at the White House so long, where you had to be kept in the background, you weren't really a foreground kind of person. Every now and then there were some articles written, but for the most part, it was, you know, always about the first family and first and foremost, and that was it. So we were domestics. We just had to take care of whatever the first family needed us to take care of, whether it be events, functions, you know, house guests, whatever it was. So,
did you have a life? Did you have to cook their Thanksgiving dinner and their Christmas dinner?
So again, the routines changed from president to president. The Carters, they were very nice. They went to Camp David every weekend, and he said they would come back Sunday, but they would come back Sunday midday sometimes. So they would have dinner at the White House on Sunday nights, and he would say, look, I have a family. I don't want you guys working on Sunday. You stay home with your family. Just leave us some leftovers and we'll get it ourselves. So I thought that he, you know, was very considerate that way. You know, he was, and just like you see him now and how he is as an elder statesman and a humanitarian. I mean, that came across even then as president, even under the enormous pressures of, you know, what was going on with the Iran. I was there his last year, his final year in the White House. So there's a lot of drama going on with the Iran hostages and so forth. It's a very trying time for him. But even then, he was completely considerate of us and, you know, wouldn't want us to stay. He said, if things were running late.
The signs of a good leader.
Pardon me?
The signs of a good leader.
Yeah, right. He was great.
And then Reagan came. Quack, 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 quack.
But, you know, politics aside, they were just as nice. I mean, you know, he would come into the kitchen and tell jokes. It was a very different setting with that. There was no family. It was just the two of them, generally speaking. They had house guests from time to time. You know, some of the kids would come and visit, Maureen and so forth.
And Nancy wanted interesting food. Is that right? I think I read that somewhere that she was a little bit of a foodie or I wouldn't go as far, but...
Yeah, you know. She was very in tune of what was being served. Mrs. Carter, and again, it was only 1 year that I had with Mrs. Carter. It was my first year, so I probably don't have as much information to go on. But, you know, Mrs. Carter would leave it up to, you know, the White House, the staff, to make sure that everything was taken care of. The florist had to take care of the flowers for the tables and the tablecloths and so forth. Mrs. Reagan, she was a little bit more hands-on. But I think she was hands-on even in the West Wing with the president's affairs to a certain extent. I mean, she always wanted to make sure that all the stuff that had to be taken care of from a wife's point of view was taken care of for him. And it was the same thing. You know, she just wanted to be sure that whenever we served something, that it showed her in the best light, showed America in the best light. You know, we were there to make sure that we showed off, you know, what Americans can do in terms of, you know, producing food. And I think that the person that she had helping her, Ted Graber, who was her kind of interior decorator, but also her confidant when it came to some of these social things. They were very, I think, you know, adamant about making sure that we put our best foot forward every time. They were very difficult to work with, but you knew what they wanted. You knew she wanted the best. So it made it a little bit easier, I thought. You know, I thought it was kind of easier.
There were high expectations, but they were clear.
Yeah, right. Exactly. You knew that you could not take a shortcut. You could not take a, you know, a second off. And that was, but that's pretty typical, right? I mean, that's even in our.
Well, I don't know. You cook at the White House. We have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, it's nice. I mean, I think that. But I think that if, you know, if you're a professional, I think that that happens even in restaurants. You really have to put your best foot forward every time. I mean, that's just the way it is.
Definitely at that level, right?
Right.
Where there's such expectations.
I mean, we cooked, you know, on a day-to-day level, on a day-to-day basis, we cooked for two people. It could just be for them, or it could be up to 500 for a reception in the afternoon. I mean, and there were only three of us in the kitchen on the savory side and one pastry chef. Then we had two part-time people come in to help out. But, you know, so it was, you know,
busy.
Very long days sometimes, yeah.
Wow.
We're going to take a short break. We're talking to Chef Frank Ruta. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef and a former White House chef, and we will be right back at the Dolcezza Sherber Experience.
And the music on this show produced by Flash Frequency, local producer here in Washington, D.C. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Full service radio. We are back at the Dolcezza Sherber Experience. We're live from the Line Hotel, and Rob and I today are talking to Chef Frank Ruta. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef, and he's a former White House chef, and he's telling us stories about cooking at the White House. Frank, I have to ask, would you cook for Donald Trump?
I mean, yeah.
There's no censorships, remember.
If it were my job, I would have to, right? Yeah. I mean, I couldn't say no, I wouldn't.
So if the White House calls, the White House calls.
Yeah. I mean, I think that if we were working there, I have no idea what goes on there. Now I don't talk, you know, whenever I do talk to the chefs there, it's only about some, you know, some other things. It's not so much about, you know, their line of work day to day. They probably get bugged enough about that. But if I were there now, I think that, you know, it would just be part of, you know, what we were doing with the White
House.
Sounds
like it'd be easier anyway. Burgers and fries, right?
Yeah, seems like it.
Bag of Doritos.
I don't know what goes
Coca-Cola.
On. But we don't hear too much about state dinners and other things that go on.
Well, definitely compared to the previous administration, that was all about food.
I think we've had two, maybe three. Not that many compared to, you know, what we've had.
All the visits to the restaurants. And
yeah. So, and then, yeah.
Times are different, you know?
Different now, yeah.
Different.
So, I also read that you met your wife at the White House.
Yeah,
Use your food to seduce her? Did you, like, I imagine there are cameras everywhere. You can't just make out in the pantry casually at the White House, or can you?
It was actually,
to find those blind spots.
Right? I used the pastry chef's cookies. She worked in the office behind us.
To lure her into the kitchen.
It was like the curator's office. You know, the White House is a living residence, but it's also a museum. So her office dealt with the museum part, all the antiquities, you know, all the things that had to be cataloged, and there were new things coming into the collection all the time, things going back out of the collection or things on loan or whatever. So her office took care of that. And it was another small office of only two or three people. So whenever she came in to work, first of all, there aren't that many people that were my age working there. Everybody, when I started, the maitre d' was from Roosevelt administration. Think about that.
Wow.
It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
So we're like, there's a young lady there. Give her some cookies. No.
Whenever she came in, it was just one thing led to another. You know, you just start talking. You say, oh, we want to go out. And we went out. And you know how it goes. You guys.
Bada bing, bada boom.
Yeah.
And then one day you left the White House and you went to Italy,
right,
to find your roots, the food of your childhood.
Yeah, so it was always
tell me more about that.
It wasn't necessarily that I wanted to go to Italy. I just wanted a European experience in the kitchen. I wanted to be in an elevated place, a 1-2 or, you know, a pipe dream 3-star restaurant. We tried like heck. Roland, the pastry chef, is French, was French, and he helped me write a ton of letters. Again, this was before the internet, so everything was done the old-fashioned way with letters or telephone calls, and he would make the phone calls for me of all the contacts he knew, and I would make the ones that I knew. And it just so happened that I ended up in northern Italy at a place called Ristorante Andrea in Murano. And it turned out to be the perfect place for me because the style of food, I didn't know about it that much before I got there, but the style of food was much in, really in tune with the way that I like to cook with, you know, a natural with fresh ingredients and not too much done to them. More the Italian
way, right?
Yeah, right. So, so it was a great experience. Yeah, I just wanted to get to Europe and work. So we worked there and then came back to the White House.
Okay.
Yeah.
And came back to the White House with Bush?
Well, whenever I left, the Reagans were still in office. So this was in 87. I came back to the States in 88. I was due to go on to Switzerland to work, but Mrs. Reagan called. She had heard I was back in the States. It was just for the holidays. It was in December. And she asked if I would consider coming back to the White House because she wasn't happy with, you know, the changes that were made. And I said, oh, well, okay, I'll come talk to the chief usher, which is kind of like the general manager, and I'll talk to, I'll sit and talk with you about some stuff. And we had a conversation, a couple of conversations, and so I decided instead of going to Switzerland,
ask her for a raise. You were like, okay, I'm coming back if you pay me this.
But no, that's pretty cool to be to be in demand from the White House.
The White House
Reagan
call again.
Calls you and says, I need you back to cook for me.
She asked if I would finish her administration, and I stayed there. I finished their administration, and I stayed for the first 15 months or so of President Bush.
So. And then after that, that's when you, did you go back to Europe after that?
No, then after that, I said, well, I always wanted to pursue opening a restaurant. So that's whenever I embarked on that after, in 91, I decided to leave. And, you know, it's not really like a restaurant setting at the White House. So I had to get back into the swing of restaurants. So I applied at a couple of restaurants in D.C. And
which ones?
The best at this time, the best chefs were Jean-Louis.
Right, at the Watergate, right?
Right, and Yannick Cam at Pavillon. Yeah. Those were the two guys that were... I mean, there were some other really good chefs in town, there's no question. Most of them were French chefs, Jean-Pierre Gorionval, Roberto Donda was just getting going, and his Galileo, Bob Kincaid, Jeff Hoover.
Was Michel Richard around?
Michel Richard wasn't here yet. Okay. It was before he came to town.
Wow.
So I ended up at Le Pavillon with Yannick and worked with him on and off a couple of different places for about the next 3 or 4 years. Pavillon closed, and we ended up going to Yannick's in Alexandria. Then we opened up Provence in downtown D.C. together.
Hmm. We are talking to Chef Frank Ruta. He's a James Beard Award-winning chef, and he's a former White House chef. You're listening to the Chetza Sherber Experience, and I want to talk about Palena. You opened Palena in D.C. In the Cleveland Park neighborhood.
Right.
It became a D.C. institution. A true dining destination, and you know, earn the respect of DC chefs, and that's when you won, I think, New Chef from Food and Wine and the Mid-Atlantic Chef, Best Mid-Atlantic Chef from the James Beard Foundation. However, I think you remain sort of this rare modern chef, because I feel like you stay, again, like I said at the beginning of the interview, very much in the kitchen. Is it true that you rarely visit the dining room at Palena, and that you don't like interviews, although you're sitting here with us?
Right. I stayed, you know, first off, the kitchen was downstairs. So for me to get up, it's not so much the physical thing, but to leave the kitchen, it would kind of throw a monkey wrench into service, and I couldn't just see it or run back or dart back and forth. So, but that was just an excuse. No, I'm not the kind of person that would go out in the dining room and make the rounds. I felt more comfortable being downstairs in the kitchen and working there.
You know, we admire that. I think this, we're in an era
with chefs,
you know, they craft their image as much as they craft what they put on a plate. And I think it's more important for them to, you know, have a lot of followers on Instagram or being top chef than actually get a 4-star review. You seem to have chosen the opposite route.
Yeah, I kind of like to be in the kitchen. I thought that it, I mean, but it's important. I mean, the other stuff is important. You know, it is kind of important to make the connection. It's not so much, I don't know, for the popularity contest or anything like that, but it is important to make a connection with the guests, you know, to come up, to talk to them, to get their feedback, to, you know, explain why, you know, where these tomatoes are coming from. I mean, they're, you know, part of dining out now is more than just, you know, just becoming just eating or the social just between the two or four people that might be at the table. It's, you know, it's more of an interaction between the establishment, the restaurant, or the hotel and the guests. And I think that if you can get there and talk to them and explain, they want to hear all, they're very interested in all this stuff. People are more worldly now than they used to be, so they can kind of make the connection a little easier.
So you do the rounds now? Have you changed?
Not that much.
Are you selling out, Frank? Please tell me no.
But no, I think that if, you know, I probably will change as, you know, further along I go. I try and get a little bit better at it. But I, you know, I still feel more comfortable in the kitchen, and I think that that's, you know, I don't know that that will change completely, but I'll still kind of. But it's important to get out and make the rounds, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's, like, I guess it's another level of, like what you said, connection.
Right, interaction.
But to transmit kind of what it is that you're doing, what's on their plate, where this comes from, because that adds to the experience.
You hear from their experiences, and, you know, you kind of grow from that, and then, you know, they kind of get from you what, you know, some other bits of information that might not be translatable through their server or on the menus.
But it is so so refreshing to hear and to connect with the old school way of things, meaning before there was the platforms of immediate feedback. And so you were cooking because that's what you wanted to do.
Right.
Yes. And it wasn't because you were doing that to get all these followers and to get the attention. It was like the motivation was more in the interior on the inside, as opposed to on the exterior to gain notoriety or fame or followers. And it's so refreshing, especially nowadays with kind of the way things are different right now.
I mean, I think that whenever people ask me about the White House, we talked a lot about the presidents and some other stuff, but whenever I think about the White House, to me, the biggest thing for me was, you know, I call it antiquated cookery. You know, the things that I learned from those three guys, they were walking encyclopedias of classical cooking. They could sit there and recite to you a classical dish and tell you exactly what should go in that dish and how it should be made. And, of course, they might argue about it, bicker about it, because one was from Switzerland, one was from France, and one was from Germany. But, you know, I think that where I came from, it was a little bit different than, it is antiquated to a certain extent. I think that some of that cooking might be kind of from a bygone era, but to me, it was just extremely valuable that I got to witness firsthand some of these things. These guys worked in Escoffier's kitchens. You know, these guys worked, when I got to work with them, they were already 50 and 60 years old. So whenever they were 13, 14, and 15 doing apprenticeships in Europe, it was back in
the depth of knowledge.
Things that we read about now, right? Yeah. So I felt very, and that's, I think, to me, what I think about is, the most fortunate. I mean, it's nice to be able to talk to Frank Sinatra and Clint Eastwood and Potsy from, you know, Happy Days. At least these are the big guys from my time there. But, you know, it was also, you know, a privilege to be able.
Did you meet Frank Sinatra?
I did meet Frank Sinatra. I'll tell you that story.
Was he the coolest guy?
He was. He had those blue eyes. So that he came, you know, so she came into the kitchen. She was having lunch with Frank Sinatra, and she walked back with him into the kitchen, and she said, "Frank, meet Frank." And I said, "Oh, hi." And he said, "How you doing?" He said, "I heard you make a mean tomato sauce." I said, "I think so." And he said, "Good." He gave me that wink. And he walked out. Then he kind of took two steps back, and he looked at me again, and he said, "So do you put oregano in your sauce?" I said, "No." He said, "Good man, good man." And he walked back. And that was my 5 minutes of fame with Frank Sinatra.
From Italian to Italian.
Yeah, Frank to Frank.
He was in the beginning, he was like in charge of the entertainment for state dinners and stuff. You know, they had people that would do different things for them to kind of that they leaned on for their expertise. There was a guy in California that the White House would suggest wines for, mostly American wines, and that once we made the menu, he would give us a list of wines that would be the appropriate pairing. Frank Sinatra would do the entertainment, and he actually was the entertainment once for the president of Italy. He and Perry Como, so we got to see them.
What was Clint doing?
Pardon me?
Hanging out, Clint Eastwood.
Oh no, he he was just
dressed like a cowboy.
You know, he and Burt Reynolds came in for something to meet Mrs. Reagan. You know, made a bit for her drug program. She was the big thing about just say no.
We remember.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I grew up
just
in the South.
No.
We want to smoke weed.
Yeah, so you didn't say no.
I was a victim of her campaign. Yeah. Thank you, Nancy.
Yeah, just say no. So I think they were probably in for that. And then he was walking around, you know, just like Clint Eastwood does, swinging those arms. And the Secret Service guys came running through the kitchen and said, "Did you see Clint Eastwood?" I said, "Yeah, he just went out that way." And he said, "Oh, he's supposed to have an escort." I said, "Well, he just walked out by himself that way." So
he's a tough guy.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking before the show here, and you were talking a little bit about how things are different now in the kitchen with food, with chefs, than what they were before. What exactly, when you say that, I was wondering, what is the differences that you see now in the kitchen with chefs? And
Again, from my perspective, you know, I think that everything had to have some sort of precedence. The guys I worked with wouldn't have put together a dish or a menu unless it had some sort of precedence in classical cooking. So it had to have, it had to be, you know,
rooted in tradition.
Yeah. Right. It doesn't mean that it can't be creative, but for them, the springboard was something in the classical repertoire that they were, how they were taught. And that's how they taught me. I think that now, you know, the evolution is with so many different techniques and the world is becoming, you know, so available to people to see what's going on all around. You know, the evolution is that it's, you know, the creativity is just, you know, going in so many different directions now, you know, new techniques, things that, you know, in my time there was just set techniques in certain ways and this is how you do it the right way. And, you know, of course people took shortcuts and, you know, it's not that we don't now or that people don't now, but I think that now to stay on top of things, you really have to kind of refresh yourself and to see exactly what's going on in the contemporary kitchen. I mean, it's an evolution. And I think that for me, the best ones are that still kind of marry some of the old and the new. I don't mind the new at all. I kind of think it's fun and exciting and delicious. And but, you know, I still like to have some kind of, you know, clarification or something. Yes, something. I think there's something. I feel more comfortable. I can identify with things a little bit easier.
And I guess, you know, with that, with those changes, I guess it all comes down, just like everything else, is how does it taste?
Yeah.
You know, does it make sense?
Yeah.
Do the flavors and the layers and the notes?
But now you get, not only, you get the visual too now. I mean, the things are a little bit different than just, a couple pieces of meat sliced with a delicious sauce and delicious cooked vegetables. Now you get the, wow, look at that. And then you take a bite and you say, oh my God, that's so
food
good.
Food is coming floating and then it explodes and then I don't know what happens.
Smoke comes from underneath the dome.
Everything. I mean, but you know, if the taste and then the experience, if it can back it all up, and
with all the changes that there are and the different ways of doing stuff and doing business and communicating and all that, I think it all still the notion of quality, the idea of quality stays.
Right.
Where I think it's like with all the new flashy stuff, if there's not something there on the inside, then it won't last.
That seemed kind of soulless, I think. Yeah, right.
Yeah, I think all that, after the smoke clears, what is really there? And I still think that is...
the roasted chicken and the burger from Palena.
Right, exactly. The smoke clears
that's
and the burger
I remember.
Is still there. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, tell me about speaking of the Palena burger. Tell
What's
me about the Palena burger.
You know, I mean, we made everything in-house except the cheese, and I just think it was, the thing about it was that everything, all the components were so simple,
that's exactly
but so
what I told Bialetta last night as she was sitting there
at
midnight preparing.
He's going to say he made everything
from
scratch.
You know what? Yeah. I guarantee it's because he's going to say everything from scratch.
We did.
The bread.
You know, and then we had people that worked in the kitchen that were passionate, so it was every single day it came out pretty much exactly the same, which you can't really... you know, discount the fact that you have passionate people, passionate, talented people working for you, you know. So it was all of that, you know. So it was, we tried to find the best ingredients we could find and just made a great tasting burger. It was just by accident that it ended up on the menu. I mean, we weren't making a burger. We served it. We had a private lunch. We were closed on Saturday for lunch. Well, we were closed for lunch all the time. But for this one Saturday, we had a prominent winemaker in from Alsace because he wanted to taste through with a critic all of his portfolio. So I said, okay, well, what are we going to cook him for lunch? He's here in America. You know, we've been making this burger for ourselves for lunch downstairs, so we're just going to make this burger. And the host said, oh, great, that'd be perfect. It was just the three of them. So we made a burger, and they were just blown away. You know, they loved this. It was so delicious. It went with the red wines. It went with this. It went with that. It was like such a great thing. So I said, oh, okay, well, we're going to put it on the cafe menu then. So it gave us the confidence to put it on the menu. And that's how it came about. Other than that, it was just something we made for ourselves downstairs. You know, it was just we made the bun. We had some extra meat. We ground it.
People still remember it, so yeah. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. Hey, Pelena is legendary in D.C.
Frank,
and all. And all the chefs and the people that you spawned from that restaurant that went out and launched their own career and their own restaurants. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, we're always lucky to have, you know, that the restaurant attracted, you know, pretty steady clientele of customers, and then it always attracted, you know, a certain group of passionate, talented cooks, you know, and then really all you kind of have to do is get one in, and it wasn't anything that I did. It was just that, you know, it kind of the one that everybody knew.
They were into doing the same things that you were doing, as far as all about the food, the quality.
Yeah, they were making it on their own. But you know, they kind of, you could see that they taught each other, you know, and we taught each other, and then that they would converse about food, and they were just into it. You know, they were just, I think that was the attraction probably for all the, you know, for everybody that they were.
When I talked to you at that event, I think it was the DC Greens event, you told me some story about the, the Fresh Farm and Yonkers and Charlie and husband and a snow day. Can you tell me the same story?
It was one of those big snows in D.C. I guess we haven't had one now for a couple of years, but it was, you know, I live in Northern Virginia, not that far, but it was still, I couldn't get out of my street, you know. And then Kelly, our manager at the time, lived in the city. So did a couple of the cooks and a couple of the servers. And she said, are we going to open? I said, you know, I don't know. I don't think so. We're not going to open. She said, well, if I can make it in, I'm going to open. I said, okay. And so she got one of the cooks to come in, or maybe two of the cooks to come in. They walked in, they trudged along. The landlord, surprisingly, had done some work on the sidewalk so that they could actually get the door open. And then they opened, and the lights were on. And we had customers that lived down the road at the Kennedy Warren and Yonkers and her husband, Charlie. And I guess they were looking for a bite to eat, and they started walking up, and they saw the lights on at Pelena. And then they walked up, and they were just thrilled that it was open. They called some friends, and they just ended up having a, you know, kind of like a impromptu kind of gathering at Pelena that night, only because the, you know, manager and one of the cooks wanted to go in and do something. So it stuck out in their mind as, you know, I didn't even know that. Of course, Kelly told me that the Yonkers are here, and these people are here, and these people are here. And I said, well, we're not going to charge them. Just kind of do whatever, you know, just have. But some years later, Anne was telling me a story how she was walking. I didn't really know the other side of the story until she related to me at one of the events or something. So it was kind of nice to hear. But that's just the kind of people that I think worked there. I mean, again, that wasn't any of my doing.
That's the true part of a neighborhood restaurant.
It's a neighborhood restaurant.
Right? Yeah. Anne is the founder of Fresh Farm Markets, the organization that started farmers markets 20 years ago or
DuPont,
more here in Washington, D.C.
Penn Quarter, and then many more.
So, Frank, you had to close Pelena, and then you work at a couple of other high-profile restaurants. What's next for you, Frank?
Are you going to come back?
I would do, maybe. We'll see. I have a list at home that I have to try to get caught up on. Son starting his senior year. So we'll see.
But it's something you would like to get back into the kitchen and cook?
Yeah, I think so. I think that there's, it's something that's, you know, always with you, right? I mean, if it's the right thing, if it's, you know, we're talking about a couple of things, if it's the right opportunity, then.
Not ready to reveal anything yet.
Yeah, we'll see.
Working on it. Be continued.
Stay tuned.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for coming in. Thanks for your stamp and your mark on DC culinary scene.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
Take care.
See you around.
All right.
Be kind to one another. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.